I want to talk about, well, I want to do a lead into supersymmetry. And for supersymmetry, we're going to use two component fermions. And I think this is something you've seen before, but I want to review it quickly because it's something that, well, for two reasons. First, we use it a lot when describing supersymmetry in four dimensions. The second of all, it's, if you like, a more natural way to describe the standard model, given the standard model gauge representations we have. So if you recall, you can classify representations of the Lorentz group in four dimensions by essentially a pair of spin quantum numbers. So you don't actually identify these with the actual spin of the particle, but the representation looks like a pair of SU2 representations, and SU2 representations look like spin. And it turns out that the 1/2 0 representation corresponds to a left-handed Weyl fermion, 0 1/2 to a right-handed Weyl fermion, and a 1/2 1/2 to the Lorentz 4 vector. And if you count kind of numbers of components, it agrees with what you'd expect. So I want to focus on these two representations today. If you like, these are the two simplest non-trivial representations of Lorentz, and it's useful to know how these work. This comes up all over the place. It comes up in supersymmetry. It comes up a lot of times when people talk about neutrinos. This is a bit of an aside, but being familiar with the structure is just a handy thing to have, and I want to go over it. Okay, so the first thing is that we have a general form of the transformation matrices corresponding to the 1/2 0 representation. So a 1/2 0 representation transformation, again, is a set of matrices that realize Lorentz transformations that agree with the Lorentz transformation multiplication law. And I'm going to write them this way. So sigma A here are just the two component, are just the usual Pauli matrices. And this looks just like a regular SU2 transformation, except this alpha A parameter, instead of being real, is complex. And specifically, we're going to write alpha A is equal to beta A minus I beta A, where A is equal to 1, 2, 3. So since this alpha A is complex, it has six real components, we identify the three theta components with rotations. And this agrees with what you get from regular spin on a spin 1/2 object. So when alpha is real, it corresponds to just a spin rotation on a two-component object. So this matches up with what we'd expect for 1/2 0. But because the Lorentz group has both rotations and boosts, it turns out that the boost part corresponds to these beta A's being non-zero. And these beta A's give you an alpha A that's complex, and all the structure is embedded for Lorentz transformations into this total transformation. So this is a 2x2 matrix. And in the usual way, when you have an exponential of a matrix, you identify it, you interpret it formally as a power series in that matrix. But it's something you've dealt with in spin, and you know how to deal with this. OK. So here we go. So by construction, a 1/2 0 spinner is one that transforms as follows. And I'm going to write the two-component indices on it explicitly. So alpha A is a two-component index. So alpha varies from 1 and 2. And this is going to be given by M alpha A alpha beta psi beta of x. Sorry, let me just multiply this. OK, so if I do a Lorentz transformation, if I do a Lorentz transformation on a 1/2 0 spinner by a Lorentz transformation that I define by lambda. So in other words, x mu goes to lambda mu nu x nu. Along with this change in the space-time parameter, my fields also transform. In this case, this field transforms in a non-trivial way. It picks up this matrix. So let me just explain my notation. This alpha and alpha beta is implicitly summed over and runs over 1 and 2. This alpha has nothing to do with this alpha. So sorry about my abusive notation. This alpha defines the Lorentz transformation. And for an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, I could identify the four-component Lorentz transformation matrix with a set of rotation parameters and boost parameters. So if you like, I can think of this lambda mu nu as being a function of alpha A. So I define my Lorentz transformation in terms of some rotation angles and some boosts. And that defines, in particular, a 4x4 matrix that realizes the vector representation, which corresponds to the 1/2, 1/2 representation. So again, I have a set of underlying group parameters that leads to explicit matrices for different objects transforming under different representations. So this is for the 1/2, 0 representation. This is how one of those objects transforms. And this is how an object in the 1/2, 1/2 representation transforms. So put another way, each thing, different representations have different sets of transformation matrices, but they all obey the same group transformation law, where we define the group elements in terms of these alpha A's. So you may be used to defining Lorentz transformations just in terms of these Lorentz transformation matrices. But an equivalent way to think about it is we define the transformation in terms of alpha A, and this four component matrix corresponds to a particular matrix representation of that group transformation. Okay. So things look pretty good. This looks a lot like an SU2 transformation. And this, when you're talking about representations, the first thing you often want to do once you figure out how something transforms is figure out how to make invariant objects under a given transformation. Because those are the things that we're going to put into our Lagrangian ultimately, if we want our Lagrangian to be invariant under these transformations. So if alpha was real, I know how to build an invariant object. I just take M dagger M, because M dagger M, I just flip the sign on the I here. I wouldn't touch the alpha, and this is a Hermitian matrix. So in the usual way, this would be unitary if alpha A were real. But unfortunately, alpha A isn't real. And because alpha A isn't real, it turns out that this is not unitary. So we need to work a little bit harder to build invariants. And it turns out that a trick to get invariant, an invariant is what I'm going to call the epsilon trick. And that is that you can show that if I take the transpose of a matrix for a given alpha, and I multiply it by epsilon, I get back epsilon. Where here, epsilon is the 2-index antisymmetric tensor. So this takes a little bit of fiddling to show, but this epsilon you can rewrite as I sigma 2. And if you sit down with this, you take the transform and you use your use the various tricks you know for dealing with Pauli matrices, it's not too hard to prove this identity. So this is nice because we put these things together into something that's essentially a fixed object that doesn't necessarily transform. And we can use this to build Lorentz invariants. And in particular, an invariant we can build given two objects that transform in this way under Lorentz is to take chi transpose epsilon psi. Because what ends up happening is this thing picks up an M. This thing picks up an M transpose. So I have an M transpose epsilon M. And that gives me back an epsilon, which gives me back the thing I started with after these things go through. And let me write this out in a suggested notation. So this chi, I'm going to write my two component objects with lower Lorentz indices, lower two component indices. And I can write this explicitly as chi beta epsilon beta alpha psi alpha. Or because this is antisymmetric, I can rewrite this as minus epsilon alpha beta chi beta, psi alpha. So I haven't done anything fancy here. I'm just rewriting this object in terms of this matrix multiplication object in terms of explicit components. Okay, so there happens to be a handy definition here. And the handy definition is that since I can take this object and attach it to this object, I get an invariant. So let's define this thing as an upper index chi. So what I mean by that is let's define chi alpha to be epsilon alpha beta chi beta. So again, this is just a two-component object, but I'm defining the object with the upstairs index as the object with the lower index with the epsilon kind of built into it. And the reason this is useful is that this object is automatically Lorentz invariant. So where I'm defining this object to be the contraction of an upstairs index on the left with a downstairs index on the right. So I'm going to define this shorthand to represent this object, which by construction is a Lorentz invariant. Okay, so this is nice. We've defined how these 1/2-0 objects transform under Lorentz transformations. It's just given by this. We define a given Lorentz transformation by a complex three-component alpha A with three rotations and three boosts. So here's the transformation. I use this trick to build this invariant. But now, because if I want to, I can lump this thing and define an upper index two-component object. So I do that this way. And that means that this combination is a shorthand for this contraction, which, if you like, is just epsilon alpha beta chi beta psi alpha, which is a Lorentz invariant. So this upstairs downstairs notation is just a matter of convention, but it's a convention that makes it easy to remember how to build Lorentz invariant objects. In the same way that there's a handy shorthand for Lorentz indices, where I can track upstairs and downstairs indices, and I get something that's Lorentz invariant. There's a lot of physics going into that, but because the notation's nice, you don't have to think about the physics all the time when you use it. You just contract upstairs or downstairs. This is the same story for two-component fermion indices. This is a nice notation that lets me just contract upstairs or downstairs and get a Lorentz invariant. And just in passing, let me apologize for my notation. I'm using Greek letters for these two-component Weyl indices. I'm also using Greek letters here for these four-component vector indices. And I also have an alpha that defines my group transformation parameter. So please try to keep these separate. So this is a group transformation parameter. These mu nus run from 0 to 3. These alpha betas go over 1 and 2. It's a bit of an abusive notation, but it's also a standard one. So it's probably best just to learn with it and deal with it. OK, so this is 1/2-0. Let's do 0/1/2. The 0/1/2 is going to be very similar. So a transformation matrix for the 0/1/2 representation, I'm going to write this as m bar of alpha A. So again, alpha A defines a particular Lorentz transformation. The m bar is the transformation matrix for the 0/1/2. And it is how do I want to write this? And it's going to be e to the minus I theta A plus I theta A sigma A over 2. So if I look at this and I look at what I had up there, it's basically the same transformation, except now I have a plus I beta instead of a minus I beta. So I can just rewrite this straightforwardly as e to the minus I alpha A star sigma A over 2. So this looks very similar to what we had before, but it's slightly different. And the slight difference is important. The next thing is for an object transforming under the 0/1/2 rep, I'm going to write it as a fermion with a bar on top. The bar doesn't mean any kind of conjugation. The bar is just a part of the name of this object that donates, that's supposed to denote the fact that it's a 0, 1 half instead of a 1 half 0. So this psi bar of x under Lorentz transformations transforms to m bar alpha a. And this alpha is a 2 by 2 matrix, so I'll only put explicit matrix indices on it. Alpha dot beta dot psi bar beta dot lambda inverse x. Where this lambda inverse is the Lorentz transformation defined by the set of boosts fixed by the theta A and the beta A. OK, so here I'm using also two component indices. So this alpha dot and beta dot, like alpha and beta above, run over 1 and 2. I'm using dots on them. The dots are conventional. And the dots are to denote that these indices correspond to the 0, 1 half representation instead of the 1 half 0. So again, this is just notation. It's standard notation. And OK, it's good to get used to it. I've also suggestively put matrices upstairs and downstairs in a slightly different way from above. And we'll see why that is in a second as well. But at this point, it's just notation. I'm just saying that this two-component object transforms into this matrix times this two-component object with a shifted argument. OK. So again, like before, the same epsilon trick as I used over here works. And it turns out that just like before, I can form a Lorentz invariant in a straightforward way. And it turns out that the straightforward Lorentz invariant I can form out of two objects transforming under the 0, 1 half representation is, I'm going to call it this. And this, again, is a shorthand like I had before. And this corresponds to chi bar alpha dot psi bar alpha dot, which is a shorthand for this thing with a lowered index I'm going to define as the object with the upper index, but so-called lowered with the epsilon tensor. So in other words, this lowered index object is just a shorthand for epsilon alpha dot beta dot chi bar beta dot with psi bar alpha dot. And using the same epsilon trick as I had up above, the M transpose and M matrices just go through each other. The same thing applies to these M bar matrices, which they have the same form, or just flip a beta to minus beta. And you can show that this object is also invariant under Lorentz transformations, in this case corresponding to the 0, 1 half representation.
Here the epsilon with Lorentzes are equal to the epsilon with upper indices, right?
So. I'll get to that in a second. But let's check it. Let me check my conventions. The lower indices have a relative minus sign. Okay, relative to the upper ones, but I'll come back to that. Okay, so we have this, and. Okay, and then here I've also defined chi bar alpha dot beta dot. So we can raise and lower indices. Did I do this before? I forgot one thing that I forgot to mention one thing over here, and that is the upstairs versus downstairs on the epsilons. The one thing I forgot, okay, this ties into your question. The thing I forgot to mention is that, okay, so for the 1 half 0, we defined the upper index object as a regular lower index object, which is kind of the regular thing, contracted with an epsilon. And we had the idea of raising the index with this. Now, if I take epsilon, epsilon bar, I get 1, where epsilon bar is minus epsilon. Because if you see, if I multiply epsilon by itself, I get minus 1, minus unit matrix. So let me define epsilon bar to be minus epsilon. And specifically, let's define this with indices such that I'll write this as epsilon alpha beta, epsilon beta gamma is equal to delta alpha beta. And that means this epsilon bar beta gamma corresponds to the matrix 0, minus 1, 1, 0, which is kind of minus epsilon. So okay, maybe this part is not so clear, but the point is that I can the point is I can invert this relation. So I can invert this relation by multiplying through by epsilon inverse, and epsilon inverse happens to be minus epsilon. So we're going to define epsilon inverse as epsilon bar, and in terms of our upper and lower index notation, our epsilon bar is going to be the guy with the lower indices, and it's just this. Now, having done that, because writing a bar and stuff is annoying, and because we're usually going to write out the indices all the time, we're going to just write, we're often going to just not put the bar on the lower index epsilon. So in other words, when you see epsilon with two upstairs indices, it corresponds to this matrix. And when you see epsilon with two lower indices, it corresponds to the inverse of this matrix, which is just the same thing with a minus one. So again, this is a standard convention. I'm not saying it's necessarily a good convention, but it's one you can get used to. It's one that you get used to, and it's not so bad in the end. And whenever there's confusion, if you just write out the indices, everything should be okay. Okay, but coming back down to here, this epsilon alpha dot beta dot, epsilon alpha dot beta dot with the upstairs indices, just to write it explicitly, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, and epsilon alpha dot beta dot is 0, 1, minus 1, 0. So with the dotted indices, the epsilons are the same as before. We just change the index names. Okay, but in any case, we have this definition, and we have that definition, and we can build Lorentz indices. We can build Lorentz invariants, and we have this idea of upstairs and downstairs indices. Now, if I compare what I did for the 1 half 0 over here and the 0 1 half here, I also played a bit of a game with the indices in that for a standard 1 half 0 object, I wrote it with a lower index. And for a standard 0 1 half object, I wrote it with an upper index. And there's a reason for that. And the reason for that, a lot of this is just notation upon notation. But it happens to be good notation in that if you just keep track of the indices, you can not have to think about stuff that you would otherwise have to think about. So what I mean by this is let's look at complex conjugation. And the idea of complex conjugation in this case is, where are we? Let's look at how a psi alpha of x transforms. So psi alpha of x is my standard 1 half 0 object, except now I've raised its index with an epsilon. So in other words, this is an epsilon alpha beta contracted into my standard 1 half 0 object. So this object transforms into, when I write everything out, an epsilon alpha lambda mm alpha a lambda a, lambda beta psi beta of lambda inverse x. So all I've done is rewrite this as this and then apply the transformation. Actually, I guess to be more precise, let's say I write it as an alpha lambda. Okay, but I can take this and then raise this index and use the epsilon trick. And specifically, what I can do is this is epsilon alpha lambda m alpha a lambda beta epsilon beta kappa psi kappa lambda inverse x. Okay, so all I've done here is I've raised this index with the epsilon. Okay, and now at this step, if we apply our epsilon trick, or at least a variation of it, and you work through the sigma matrix ology, you can show that this combination, this epsilon m epsilon, coincides with e to the plus I alpha a sigma a transposed over 2. Alpha kappa psi kappa of lambda inverse x. So okay, at this stage, I've just looked at essentially the epsilon, this epsilon trick up here applied to this object, where I have an epsilon transformation epsilon. I work through all the sigma matrix stuff. And when the smoke clears, this takes some work, but when the smoke clears, you find that I get an e to the plus I alpha a sigma transpose over 2. And if you recall, the sigma matrices are all equal to the transpose except for the 2 component. And the reason the 2 component changes is because the 2 component corresponds to this epsilon thing. And the epsilon thing is essentially an I sigma 2. And bringing that I sigma 2 through changes the 2 component here into its transpose. And then I can apply this to everything, and I get a sigma transpose A for everything. Okay, so this has been a little bit complicated, but the upshot of this is that if I look at this and then I look at my 0, 1 half transformation, my 0, 1 half transformation looks a lot like this if I take its complex conjugate. So in other words, if I take the complex conjugate of this, sigma A transpose turns into sigma dagger, which is sigma A because it's Hermitian. My alpha A turns into alpha A star, and I get a minus sign here. So the point, so the observation is that this matrix is just the complex conjugate of this 0, 1 half transformation matrix. So okay, so I'm going to try to find I'll use some purple chalk for this. Conjugate. Okay, so in other words, this thing is just our M bar we had over here with a complex conjugate. So the upshot of all this is that here we have a psi A. And the implication of this is that if I take a psi alpha and I take its complex conjugate star, this is an object that transforms into 0, 1 half representation. Because if I look at its transformation matrix, if I take the complex conjugate of this, that corresponds to taking the complex conjugate of this. And when I take the complex conjugate of this, this is going to be a psi star with an upper index. And this will just be the M bar 0, 1 half transformation matrix over here. So the whole point is that this object transforms in a 0, 1 half manner. So we can rewrite this in our notation in terms of an object with a bar on it and a dotted index. And this is where the upstairs versus downstairs stuff comes in. Because this thing transforms like a 0, 1 half object, our notation is going to be that we're going to write this as a psi bar alpha dot. So in other words, given a 1 half 0 representation, psi with a lower alpha, if I take that psi with a lower alpha and I raise its index with an epsilon and take its complex conjugate, I get something that transforms as a 0, 1 half in the other representation. And as a matter of notation, we're going to write it this way. So in other words, this is the 0, 1 half representation that we derived from the one that have zero rep that I call psi alpha. So this is where all the notation comes together. So the whole upstairs versus downstairs, dotted versus undotted, bar versus no bar. The bar, again, let me emphasize, is just part of the name of a 0, 1 half object. And the alpha dot versus alpha is just a matter of distinguishing between the different kinds of representation indices. But what I can do, and this is where the notation becomes very handy, given any old 1 half 0 spinner psi alpha, I can form a 0, 1 half spinner that I call psi bar alpha dot by complex conjugating and raising and lowering of the indices. So this is going to be this is a handy result. And we're going to apply it down the road. But the upshot of this is that whenever we have a left-handed spinner, we can always rewrite it in terms of a right-handed spinner, or vice versa. Given a right-handed spinner, we can rewrite it in terms of a left-handed spinner. Okay. Now, okay, so and then if I write this out explicitly, psi bar alpha dot, we're going to be defined as the object epsilon alpha dot beta dot of psi star beta dot. Okay. So we have our 1 half 0 and 0 1 half objects. And in the same way, I can go in the opposite direction. And let me just raise blackboards. OK, in the same way, starting with a right-handed spinner, I can form a left-handed spinner. And our definition is going to be chi alpha will be defined as epsilon alpha beta chi bar star of beta. So I haven't done anything terribly special here. These are just definitions that match up with all the notation. So I realize there's a lot of notation here. Once you get a bit of practice with it, it ends up being very easy. But at the start, it can seem like a lot of stuff to get used to. OK, so we've built Lorentz invariants. We've built psi bar chi bar and chi psi. So these are nice Lorentz invariants. But we also want Lorentz invariants where we can put in derivatives. So ultimately, we're going to want to make Lorentz invariants and put them into an action for fermion fields that makes sense. So these bilinear objects are going to give us mass terms in the usual way. When I have two fields, that corresponds to a mass term. But we want kinetic terms. And for a fermion kinetic term, we want something with one derivative. And in direct notation, this looks like something like a psi bar, I gamma mu, del mu psi. And we want to do something similar here. And it turns out there's a similar trick here as well. So let's define the object sigma mu alpha alpha dot. So these are a set of 2x2 matrices, where I write my matrix indices with alpha and alpha dot. And I'm going to define this to be for mu equals to 0, the unit matrix, and for, so here, mu is equal to 0, 1, 2, 3. It's just a usual Lorentz index. This alpha and alpha dot are the two component indices. And I'm going to define this object to be the unit matrix in the 0th component and just the regular Pauli matrices in the IJK, the 1, 2, 3 components. And then this corresponds to their two component matrix indices. OK. So very suggestively, I've written those indices. And let's go ahead and contract stuff up. And let's contract stuff up and form this thing, which is my shorthand definition for psi alpha, psi mu, alpha alpha dot, chi bar alpha dot. So all these indices are contracted up nicely. And this is just a shorthand notation for this. But at this point, I've kind of cheated on contracting up my indices. Because I've cheated on contracting up my indices because I haven't specified what happens to this object under Lorentz transformations. But we can sit down and work through that and see what happens. So if I apply a Lorentz transformation to this, this thing is going to get an M matrix. This thing is going to get an M bar matrix. And this thing is then going to look like M sigma M bar. And we're interested in what that looks like. So let me write this out explicitly. Under Lorentz transformations, this thing transforms into, yeah, there are a lot of indices here, but I'm just trying to get all the. So all I've done here is transform the psi in the usual way and the chi bar in the usual way. This is just some set of numbers, so it doesn't do anything. But we can rewrite this as so I'm lumping a bunch of stuff in here in just regular matrix notation. Like so. So all I've done is, wait, so here I have an M lambda beta. I've flipped the indices on here to give me a minus sign, which comes out here. And that gives me an M times epsilon sigma M bar, which I've lumped all into here. And then I just match up the indices to match everything up. So this thing. OK, I realize it looks a bit like a meow, but in any case, that just happened. I'm not going to prove this, but you can do this with a bit of work. And I have a link to some old notes of mine that show this explicitly. This thing turns out to be an epsilon beta lambda lambda mu nu sigma nu lambda beta dot. Where specifically, this is the Lorentz transformation matrix corresponding to the set of rotations and boosts defined by alpha A. Okay, so again, if you think about defining a Lorentz transformation, I need 6 parameters, 3 rotations, 3 boosts. We're defining them implicitly through these sets of alpha A, this theta A and beta A. And given a set of theta A and beta A, this defines a unique Lorentz 4-vector transformation lambda mu. So this is just a lambda corresponding to that particular alpha A, corresponding to the one half transformation. So the upshot of all this, though, is that I take this and I put it back down in here. And this implies that under Lorentz transformations, I have psi sigma mu chi bar transforming after I move the epsilons back around and fix up the signs and all the smoke clears, turns into lambda mu nu. Psi sigma nu chi bar. So it takes a little bit of work to show this. I won't go through it, but please believe me, this is what comes out. But the upshot of all this is that this combination that I've called psi sigma mu chi bar, I've implicitly put a Lorentz index on it. And it turns out that I was justified in doing that. And I was justified in doing that because this object transforms like a Lorentz 4-vector. So this just goes to this, and it just has the usual Lorentz 4-vector transformation corresponding to a one half representation of the Lorentz group.
I'm sorry. The reason that this works with the Pauli matrices is just that if you write the gamma matrices in the parallel basis, they can be written like with the sigma matrices and the octahedral, right? So you're basically formulating this in this two times two-dimensional
Yeah, but we can do this without any reference at all to the four component story.
Okay, because we had something similar, right? We had like psi bar gamma mu psi, something like this.
Oh yeah.
So that's just the analog in the wild basis.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So actually, we'll come back to we'll get back to four component stuff in a bit later. But yeah, the four component you can think of as coming out from this. Or okay, you can go both directions, but it's exactly the same idea. Okay, so in retrospect, this shouldn't be too surprising, but it comes out nicely. And the great thing about this is that this gives us a place to put in a derivative. So we know that derivatives transform as Lorentz 4 vectors, so we can now make an object with derivative to give us a kinetic term. And this is what we need for our Lagrangian. Now, let me also mention that, okay, we have this. We can also form another thing that I'm going to call sigma bar mu with a slightly different index structure. Sorry. I want upstairs indices. And this thing is going to be a set of four matrices, a set of four 2x2 matrices. But now in the spatial pieces, I have a minus sign. So relative to what I had before, what I had a plus sign, I now have a minus sign. And in the same way, I can now form this object, which is a shorthand for psi bar beta dot psi bar mu beta dot beta psi beta. And just like we had before, you can show that this object transforms into lambda mu nu chi bar sigma bar nu psi. So again, the same thing that we had over here applies over here. This is just a slightly different contraction. And it turns out that this contraction is not independent of that. And specifically, you can do this by showing, okay, again, this is just a matter of a bit of fiddling, that alpha alpha dot corresponds to epsilon alpha dot beta dot epsilon alpha beta of sigma mu beta beta dot. So again, this is just a set of identities that happen to apply to these Pauli matrices, and it's not hard to prove. You just sit down and work it out. Okay. The other thing this shows is that our upstairs index structure here versus the downstairs index structure here is consistent with raising and lowering with the epsilon tensors. So sometimes people describe these epsilon matrices as being kind of the equivalent of a metric on this vial space, in the sense that you have upstairs and downstairs indices, and the epsilon is what allows you to connect them. So okay, it's not actually a metric, but it's a way of forming invariants in a nice way. There are also various other nice relations satisfied by the Pauli matrices. I won't go through them. What I want to get to next, though, is actually building Lagrangians for these two-component vial fields. So we have these things that are going to turn into kinetic terms. We have those things that are going to turn into mass terms. And now let's put them together and actually make a Lagrangian.
Just for the double check, like here you use the dot for the first epsilon and like non-dotted but create indices for second epsilon. But are those two epsilons or same thing, same epsilon?
Oh yeah. So numerically, an epsilon with upstairs indices is
are always the same. Even
yeah.
If I put the dot.
Yes. Yeah. So it's the same matrix, and I just have different. I'm attaching different components to it. But yeah. No. Good question. It's the same. Yeah. The upstairs is always the 0, 1, minus 1, 0, and the lower is always yeah. Whether or not there's a dot. Okay. So I got this. Okay, so we want to build Lagrangians. And to build Lagrangians, let's start with, where are we? Okay, so to build a Lagrangian, or I should say an action ultimately, we want our action to be real. The reality of the action makes your quantum theory unitary, if you think about it in the path integral formulation. And the second thing we want is Okay. The second thing we want is, suppose I start with a spinner psi. The spinner psi, let's say it transforms in the 0, 1 half representation. We want to make a real object at the end of the day. And that means that to get real stuff at the end of the day, starting with psi, we typically also want its complex conjugate psi bar. So whenever we start with writing a Lagrangian for psi, to get something that's Lorentz invariant and has a non-trivial kinetic term, we're also going to need its complex conjugate psi bar, which you recall is just psi with a complex conjugate, and you raise or lower the indices. So necessarily, whenever I start with a 1 half 0 object, I'm also going to have a 0 1 half to get a sensible Lagrangian. The next thing is that we're going to use these to describe fermions. And to describe fermions, we typically deal with Grassmann-valued objects. So Grassmann-valued objects, if you recall, and you must have seen this in your regular quantum field theory course, are objects that anti-commute. So if you think, so when you formulate quantum field theories for fermions, instead of imposing commutation relations, you impose anti-commutation relations. And the classical limit corresponds to where the commutators, well, for bosons vanish, or anti-commutators for fermions vanish. And that means that for bosons, the classical limit, these bosonic fields commute. In the classical limit for fermions, the corresponding fields anti-commute. So anti-commuting things are what we call Grassmann valued. So this is the standard thing for formulating a theory of fermions. You have Grassmann valued anti-commuting objects. So the same goes for the same goes for whether things have an upstairs or downstairs index, and this is just what you expect from complex conjugating.
In what sense is this a classical analysis?
Sorry?
In what sense is this a classical analysis? You said in the classical limit, this is what you.
Yeah. So it turns out that if you want to write down a classical theory of fermions, they'd all just anti-commute completely.
No, I'm saying what we're doing. In what sense is this classical? I mean.
Oh no, I'm just saying that for now I'm just writing down a Lagrangian.
Okay.
And writing down a Lagrangian, if I don't do anything to it, I'm not saying whether it's quantum or classical. I mean, ultimately we're going to study the quantum field theory you build out of it, but in principle I could also define a classical theory of fields with bosonic fields or fermionic fields, where I don't necessarily quantize them. But yeah, we're going to quantize them, but I'm just saying that in the classical limit, these things anti-commute. In the same way that the boson fields anti-commute in the classical limit. Okay. So anyway, so these are all Grassmann valued, and okay, this is going to be something we're going to have to worry about. I also want to define a notion of complex conjugation, or specifically Hermitian conjugation. So suppose A is any of these Grassmann valued objects. I'm going to define a dagger for a single thing as just this complex conjugate in the usual way. I'm going to define the Hermitian conjugate of a bunch of objects to be the same as its complex conjugate. And I'm going to define this to be the set of these objects with the order reversed. So this is just a generalization of the usual thing where you do with, if you look at the transpose of a product of matrices, the transpose is the reversed order product of their transposes. I'm going to define this notion of complex conjugation for these fermionic objects this way. So it turns out that this is going to make everything nice and consistent. So in particular, let's look at let's look at two things. So the first thing let's consider is this humble Lorentz invariant we had before. And you might worry that, okay, I have this object and this object, and if they anti-commute, I should be able to flip them. You get a minus sign. What's happening there? So it turns out that this when you keep track of our definition of raised and lower indices is equal to this. And the way to see this is that this thing, if you recall, is psi alpha. This thing is chi alpha psi alpha, which I can rewrite as epsilon alpha beta chi beta psi alpha. So here I've just rewritten this upstairs index object with an epsilon and a lower index. And now I can anti-commute them. So anti-commuting them gives me an epsilon alpha beta chi alpha, psi alpha chi beta. Sorry, that should be lower. Okay, it's hard to do indices in real time. All I've done is, I've written this out, and then I've anti-commuted them, which gives me a minus sign and psi chi. But now I see that this minus epsilon alpha beta is equal to plus epsilon beta alpha, because it's anti-symmetric. But epsilon beta alpha, it's psi with an upstairs index. So this just turns out to be a psi beta chi beta, which is, as I claimed, chi psi. So this is just a word of warning. Naively, you might expect that this thing should be minus that. But when you keep track of the upstairs and downstairs indices and track them through, there's actually no minus sign. So until you get the hang of this, I strongly recommend writing out the indices and dealing with the gory details. But once you get the hang of it, it turns out to be very straightforward. So that's the first thing. The other thing you can show is let's take the complex conjugate of chi psi dagger. This is going to be epsilon alpha beta chi beta psi alpha dagger. And now I apply my complex conjugation rule. My complex conjugation rule is that this is epsilon alpha beta. And then this is going to flip these things. And it's going to turn this guy into its complex conjugate. But its complex conjugate is just the corresponding barred object with a dotted index. And the same thing for the chi. Where are we? Chi bar beta dot. Okay, and then I'll put these indices here. So here I've flipped the order of these for free. And then I've used the fact that chi bar alpha dot, the complex conjugate of this is this object with the downstairs index that I write is alpha dot. But now if I look at this, remember that the rule for contracting the dotted things is psi bar alpha dot epsilon alpha dot beta dot chi bar beta dot, which is our definition of the contraction psi bar chi bar. So I hope everybody can see this. So the upshot of this is that if I take the Hermitian conjugate of chi psi, I get back psi bar chi bar. And it has the same form as this, but no minus sign, and just the thing going to the bar of itself. So this means that if you want to write a real object in the Lagrangian, I'm going to take this complex object and add its complex conjugate. And its complex conjugate takes exactly the same form as what I started with, but now I just put bars on everything. So this is the story for these bilinears. We also want to look at the complex conjugation properties of these things. So for the complex conjugation properties of those things, it's also fairly straightforward. Okay, so in fact, we're going to want to write Okay. Well, so the thing we normally write down, it will turn out, is to get a kinetic term for a field psi. The thing that's Lorentz invariant will be that. And then I'm going to put a 1/2 here. And let's put in something that looks like it's complex conjugate. Mu d mu psi. An I here. Okay. Let me just factor out the I. Okay, so it turns out that this is a kinetic term. And if you work through the complex conjugation in the same way as before, you can show that this piece corresponds to the complex conjugate of this. But what I can do beyond that is I can use my various epsilon tricks, like the sigma bar mu alpha dot alpha being related to the sigma mu alpha alpha dot. And it turns out that these pieces are actually equal to each other. So often you'll see the fermion kinetic term written as I sigma bar mu del mu psi. And it turns out that this is real, but this thing turns out to be equal to this and is equal to this together. So the 2 1/2s combine to give me a 1. And all I've done here is I've used the fact that this is equal to, after some manipulation, psi bar. So again, this is something that's fairly straightforward to prove by just fiddling around and using the identities of the sigma matrix.
Here, like, we define the dagger without transpose. Like, is there any good reason to do so? Like, when you calculate the pi psi dagger, like, you didn't act transpose and epsilon, right? So.
Yeah, well, so it turns out that this is the easy to use definition in this case. So the transpose is kind of built in the sense that I reverse the order. Okay. And the other thing is, if you think about acting on a single object, the single object only has one index. So there's nothing to transpose there. So, okay. In any case, this gives us our conjugate, and we have a notion of reality. And this is our kinetic term for a single 1/2 zero vial fermion. The next thing we can do to add to the Lagrangian is add a bilinear to correspond to a mass term. And the simplest possible mass term I can write down that's consistent with reality turns out to be minus 1/2 m psi bar psi psi minus 1/2 m sar psi bar psi bar. So I have this plus its complex conjugate. This whole thing's real. And this is a bilinear for the fermion. And I can identify this with a fermion mass. OK.
So is it m star? Is it the complex parameter? Or?
At this point, yeah.
All right.
So OK. So in general, this thing can be complex. But what I can always do, given this structure, is do a field redefinition. So I can do a field redefinition at this level such that I rephase phi, psi, and I rephase psi bar oppositely. And I can do that, and I have enough freedom there to actually make this real by just choosing my variables a nice way. So at this level, with only a single mass term, there's no physical phase in it. I'm just writing it with a complex conjugate just to be fully general. OK, so this piece, this kinetic term plus the mass term, is my basic free theory 1/2 zero vial fermion Lagrangian. And we can go off and do more interesting things. And the more interesting things we can do with more than one fermion is write down different kinds of mass terms. So I'll come back to that tomorrow and then apply this specifically to supersymmetry. So I realize there's a lot of notation here. The notation ends up, even though it looks like a lot, it ends up being very functionally useful. And it's probably good practice to get used to fiddling with it a little bit, because it comes up in a lot of places. So I'll wrap it up there. Let me know if you have questions. And otherwise, I'll see you tomorrow.